We're going to talk this morning about donor development and about fundraising. Now, the first thing I have to tell you is I lied. On the front of your sheet here, it says six cornerstones. I only have five. I can make one up. I only have five. I used to have six. The sixth one, I guess, didn't work, so I kind of tossed it out. You have an outline here. Let me just move this down a bit. You have an outline here that pretty much covers what I'm going to talk about. The outline is very specific in terms of covering the things I'm going to be saying, because I want you to be able to listen. Yes, you can't hear it now. Okay, let's try that. How's that? Is that better? No? How's that? No? Yes? We're going to be putting down about mid-tie level. That's good? That's better? Okay, good. All right. But I want you to be able to listen and ask lots of questions. What I'm going to do is run through real quick the outline that we have here, and we're going to leave lots of time at the end for questions. We don't have all the answers. We may be deaf by the end of this if I keep moving around. We don't have all the answers as far as fundraising and donor development go. I don't know if there are any. What I do know is that if you have some basic philosophies in place, you'll be successful, and the folks in your church will feel cared for, and they'll grow in their relationship with Christ. That's what this is all about. This is not a session for you to learn how to raise piles of cash. Maybe that'll happen. If it does, that's great. That's not my goal. It's not the goal of Willow Creek or your church, I'm sure. Really, you know, folks that give and worship God with the resources do it out of an overflowing heart rather than because someone put the stiff arm on them and kind of pried the resources out of their wallet. Willow Creek, we're a seeker-driven church. You've heard that probably till you're blue in the face the last few days. What that means is that we really focus our energies and our time on folks who don't know Christ and who maybe in some cases have had no church background at all. So on the weekends when we have fundraising approaches and that type of thing, it's very low-key, and it's done with the seeker in mind. If you look at any weekend service, hopefully this weekend you have a chance to be here on a Saturday evening or Sunday morning service, it's very clear how we approach this. One of the statements that is almost trademarked here at Willow Creek is this. This is the time in our service we receive our weekly gifts and offerings. If you're a visitor here tonight or this morning, we want you to know that you are a guest, and this part of the service is not designed for you. This is a time for those of us in the church who are part of Willow Creek who want to give back to God a small portion of the resources he's entrusted to us. And we really mean that. Our goal on the weekend is not to try and get every person that walks in the door to give. Our goal is to share Christ with them. The giving takes care of itself if God has the opportunity to do his work in their heart. We do teaching from time to time, primarily at New Community. We do some on the weekends. It's important to recognize that, you know, there is a big difference between teaching about giving and asking for money. Big difference. We are all responsible to teach about giving because it's one of the spiritual gifts God's given. It's part of the full counsel of God. Folks that have that gift want to develop it, believe it or not. They want to learn how to give the resources away more effectively and strategically. So we do teach about it. We try to stay away from lots of fundraising appeals and that type of thing. Hopefully fundraising happens in kind of a different format. We'll talk more about that in a little while. Seekers, a lot of them, many of them, most of them, all of them, I don't know, carry around with them baggage about fundraising. And you know what? Christians do too. The reason that when we talk about this whole idea of fundraising that we're all kind of nervous, we all kind of feel uneasy, is because we've all been victimized, is my guess, at one point or another, by someone calling us on the telephone, by some 11-year-old kid who comes to the door and puts the arm on you, by some church that raised resources inappropriately. And so we all have these feelings inside about fundraising, guilt and pressure and fear and all these things. We need to realize that when folks come to us, whether your church or my church, they have that stuff with them. We recognize it's there, and we try and work under the understanding so that we don't highlight those fears. In fact, hopefully, we can put those fears to rest. Our goal, I'll say it a whole bunch of times, is not to extract resources from people. It's to share the gospel of Christ and to allow people to grow and become fully devoted followers. Giving takes care of itself. That's what the Holy Spirit's for, to work in their hearts through teaching and education. If we're doing our job through network and teaching from the pulpit, our good sense ministry, that part of it will happen. And it's very important as well to understand that why people give. Bottom line, people give when they're being fed and they're growing and they're learning about Christ. People don't give because you put some slick presentation together. And they don't give because you pressure them or you guilt them into it or you give some tearful speech about how your Sunday school program's going to close down next week if folks don't give. That may work in the short term. Long term, folks are hurt, offended, and really turned off by that type of thing. So it's important to understand that, folks give out of a joyful, worship-filled spirit if the church is doing its job. I told the folks last night, if you get to a point where you feel like folks in the church aren't giving, rather than pointing the finger out to all the people in the congregation, point it back at yourself and say, what is it that we're not doing to make this place a vital and growing place? What responsibility do we have in this? How can the church be more effective in meeting its mission statement? I think responsibility in almost every case, when you talk about issues where there's a revenue shortfall, some falls in the church, some falls in the body. The church, I mean the leadership, the pastors, the staff, they need to own part of that. They can say, well, we're killing ourselves, this and that, but if folks aren't giving, there's still a systemic problem there. It may go back to the way you're preaching the gospel, the way you're trying or not trying to meet folks' needs. We talk about donor development, fundraising. You cast the vision, you don't beg for money. Folks don't give because they want to build buildings or because they want to do all these other things. They give because they want to invest in a vision. They want to invest in something they believe in. They want to invest in something they think can make a difference, that will glorify God in the long term, in something they feel might serve them or their family, help their kids grow up knowing and loving Christ. The point isn't to ask for money. The point is to share the vision, to share what God's laid in your heart for your ministry. If folks understand that, and if God's working in them the same way he's working in you, they'll understand it and want to participate fully. But that's your responsibility. They need to know what you're all about. And we'll talk a little bit more about communication and the responsibilities that we have to communicate to folks in our churches what's being done with their resources. That's a responsibility we have. Now, we communicate with folks in the church in several different ways when it comes to resources. There's some things that we do. We talk directly about fundraising and that type of thing. There are other things we do to give them feedback on how their resources are being strategically invested in the church. One of the things that we do is we receipt all of our gifts. Now, when I say that, we do it in several different ways. If some folks may contribute to us, say they give us some shares of stock, that happens from time to time, and they do it in your church as well. We'll write them a letter back acknowledging the gift, and there's all kinds of legal ramifications as to how you do that we won't cover now. But we also do contribution statements to our people. And I think in your packet there, you have one on the second page. It's just an example of the type of thing that we're trying to do. If you invest resources in IBM, what you expect from them are several things. You expect them to be profitable, you expect a quarterly dividend, you expect the company to grow, and you expect to get a quarterly annual report. You want them to tell you how it is they're doing, how they're using your resources, and what it is they plan to do for the future. If they're not doing that, chances are you won't invest with them, because you won't trust them. In the church, we miss, I think, often the responsibility of communicating to our investors. The people who give to a ministry are investors. They invest strategically, and they deserve and responsibly should receive some information on what the church is doing. Why should I keep investing in this place? What are they doing with my resources? Are they making a difference here? Are people coming to Christ? Are ministries growing? Are lives being changed? This is a letter that we sent out at the end of the first quarter in April of this year. We send out a letter just like this, different information and content, but the letter's in the same format, every quarter. And What we're trying to do here is several things. First, we want to acknowledge the fact that these folks have been contributors to Willow Creek, and we're grateful for that. They gave $500, $5,000, or $50,000. We're grateful that God's working in their heart, that they're making some kind of sacrifice for the resource to say, I want to invest in Willow Creek. Second, you'll notice in the first paragraph in this particular letter, the amount they've given over the past 3 months, I guess, is listed there. That just gives them feedback, you know, where they're at, let them know how they're done for the year, kind of put it before them once again to think about and play about. And then finally, and I think the most important part of all, is the rest of the letter is focused on giving people feedback. We want them to know what's happening. See, Willow Creek's a big place. Whether it's big or small, they may not have insight into all the things that are happening here. It's hard to take time during the services to talk about all the wonderful things that are going on because there's so many things we want to do. We want to have worship and great teaching time and drama and music and all those things. And so it's hard to take time for kind of business things. Say, well, student impact's really growing. And this is one way we can do that. In this particular letter, we talked about what's happening with the West Expansion. In fact, we just dedicated it. It's open. Folks were there. They're enjoying it. Promised Land's in there now. The new community atrium is now serving some meals. We talked a little about the recent series we were in, the impact that's having throughout the church. These are the kinds of things that folks want to know. They really want to know what's happening in the church. They want to know that what they're doing and what they're a part of is making a difference. We send one of these out every quarter, four times a year. At the end of the fourth quarter, in addition to a letter, we also send them a statement that is kind of a summary of all their gifts. It shows the date, the check number, the amount for everything they gave. So they can go back and reconcile or prepare their tax return, whatever they want to do. That's kind of a convenient form. A lot of folks appreciate it. There's a mistake, they call us and we correct it, and it's no problem. But we do that just one time a year with the full statement. You know, with folks that give, it's very important to recognize them appropriately. You know, we all hear the stories of the small church where one person is a big giver and he's the power player, the chairman, the board, and all this stuff. My sense is that he probably wasn't recognized appropriately. He was recognized inappropriately. All of us have gifts and abilities. If you come to Willow Creek and you have the gift of teaching or the gift of shepherding or creative communication, then we'll find a place to plug you in. We'll find you a place you can be fulfilled, where you can care for people, share your vision, develop your gift, make a difference in the body. But if you come to Willow Creek or any other church, at least until recently, with the gift of giving, what happens? Oh, we don't talk about that. We don't talk about that. Well, we don't talk about it because so many folks carry all this baggage I talked about before. They have all this stuff they're carrying around saying, oh, gosh, I mean, giving. You're all trying to get money out of me. Well, if you look at it from the giver's perspective, someone with the gift of giving really has a desire to develop that gift. Believe it or not, they want to give their resources away. That's their gift. That's how God put them together. They may have lots of money, they may have little money. They still want to learn how to use that gift. So it's important, I think, in a church to recognize those people in such a way that you kind of, build relationships with them. And we'll talk a little more about that, but for right now what I want to talk about is just some thank you notes that we'll send out on occasion to some of the larger gifts we receive. Now, there's all kinds of camps on this. Some folks say you shouldn't recognize them and that type of thing, but I'll tell you what, if you invested $25 or $30 million in IBM stock, I guarantee you, you'd get a letter from someone in that company saying, thanks, we'd get it for lunch sometime. That's a significant investment. Well, if someone makes a $5,000 or $10,000 investment in your church, I think it's appropriate that you contact him and say, thanks. I mean, gee whiz, that's really wonderful. I mean, do you want to like get connected with the church so you know how that money is being used or whatever? It's very important. Appropriately. The point isn't to meet them and get more money out of them. The point is to appreciate them, find out if you can plug them in the church, get them involved somehow. But I think a thank you is appropriate if it's done the right way. When you send these kinds of letters out, just a few thoughts for what they're worth, you don't use mailing labels. Mailing labels are very impersonal. They communicate a lot of things to people that you don't want to communicate to them. These letters, when they go out, it'll say, Ken Filippini and Julie Filippini, and I have our address on here. And you know what? That means a lot to people. We try and make sure we know the names, they're spelled right, the address is right, that's written on the letterhead and on an envelope in a nice way, rather than just slapping a mailing label on crooked and sending it out. You get stuff like that, what do you think? Oh, it's junk mail. So the form letter, you know, whatever. That communicates things to folks that you don't want to communicate. It communicates you don't care, that you're just doing this to satisfy some need of some board member, to raise more resources, whatever. But you really are trying to appreciate folks when you send these out, to put some care into them, put some time into them. Early on, for the first year and a half or so, I actually hand-signed every letter I sent out. We send out about 2,000 or 3,000 at a time. It took a long time to do that. I don't do it anymore because it's just gotten beyond my ability to do that. But maybe in your church you can still do that. Anything you do that makes a personal touch goes a long, long way. When I read these things, there are many that I still do sign. I still do sign a portion of them. And if I know the folks, I'll handwrite a note on there saying thanks. Hope you're doing well. You know, glad you're part of the church. And I mean it. It comes out of my heart. I know these folks. Well, it means a lot to them. You know, in this big, huge place, somebody cares about them. Somebody recognizes them as a meaningful part of the ministry. And they feel valued as a result. Now, we talked a little bit about this whole donor relations thing. You know, how you interact with people in your church who are donors and givers, large or small. One of the things that we've tried to do, and I've tried to focus some energy on in the past few years, is get connected with people in the church who have a passion for giving, or who maybe are large contributors, folks who could play a strategic role here one way or another and who need to be communicated. Now, typically what I'll do is I'll take someone like Bob here, and I'll call him up and I'll say, Bob, Ken Philippini from Willow Creek. Oh, hi, how are you? You know, they usually know who I am just because of the letters or whatever. And I'll say, let's have lunch. And, okay, great. And then right before we hang up, they always say, what are you going to talk about? First thing they ask me. And I say, I don't have an agenda. I want to get to know you. You've been a faithful contributor to the church. I appreciate what you've done. I want to spend some time with you. Oh, great, great, great. So we go out to lunch. And there's four things I try to accomplish in those lunches. Just four things. I try to encourage the people personally, not only for their contribution to the church, but just personally as a gift that I have, and I enjoy using it, so I try and encourage them. I thank them directly. Thanks for contributing to Willow Creek. We're just grateful that you do it. It makes a difference. Folks are being touched and changed. Thanks. I try to do strategic discipleship. If these folks, in many cases, you know, I find that folks who are really committed to their businesses may not be growing personally, spiritually, may not be connected personally, spiritually in the church. I try and connect them and get in touch with them or get them in touch with other folks so that in some way the church isn't just a place they write a check to. It's a place that helps them to grow and become a fully devoted follower. And fourth, I share the vision with them. I tell them about Willow Creek. Here's what's going on. Here's where we're going. Here's the series coming up. Here's what's happening with the building program. Wait to hear the message this weekend or see the drama or whatever. But I try and share vision with them. I want them to know that Willow Creek has been and will continue to be a place where we feel God is leading us to a significant work. It's funny because I don't give them a hard sell. And they're almost always shocked when we get done with lunch. They say, well, like, aren't you going to ask me for any money? No. Why would I do that? Why? I don't have to ask you for money. Maybe someday when you and I know each other better, we could talk about that. But for right now, that's not my goal. My goal is to do these four things with you, to get you connected to Willow Creek, to appreciate you for what you've done here, and see if there's a way I can serve you. And that's it. And they're shocked. I sat down with one guy after a lunch like that. We got done. We're walking out of the building. He stopped and turned to me and said, you know, for the first time, this church became personal to me. Because someone reached out to care for them. They didn't want anything. They didn't say, well, give us that or give us your time. They just appreciated me for who I am. That went a long way in his life. Caring for people is the whole bottom line. That's what donor development is all about. It's caring for people. That's what ministry is, isn't it? Isn't ministry a task that involves building people? Well, if you're doing that, then all the other things take care of themselves. Folks want to give and serve and lead and attend and all those things because you're caring for them and doing the thing that God called you to do. So caring for people is the bottom line. Now, one thing that I do is I get to know folks over time. Is I try to find out what their passion is in church. So I meet different folks from time to time who have a passion for different kinds of ministries in the church. And that's helpful because, remember, these are people who want to contribute resources, and they're even more fired up to contribute to something they feel strongly about. So as the church year goes on, if I find that we have a need somewhere in the church, I'll call them up and I'll say, hey, Bob, listen, you know, Promised Land's got a need. I know you have a great heart for them. No pressure. You just think about this. Here's a couple things they need to deal with. They can't afford in their budget. What do you think? He thinks about it, says yes or no. Either way, it gives him an opportunity with no pressure to invest in something he's passionate about. But at the same time, he feels free enough to say no, either I can't do it right now, or I don't want to do it, or I have another passion, whatever. But it's important to find out what folks' passions are, because they really do want to give the things they're passionate about. I talked a little before about the gift of giving versus substantial resources. Not every person who has a lot of resources has a gift of giving. Be very, very clear on that. There are a lot of people who have lots of money who don't want to give a dime away. And there are a lot of people with very little money who want to give it all away. Spiritual gifts are assigned by God and the Holy Spirit. The gift of giving is one of those. Not every person with lots of resources has it. Now, I'll tell you, my experience is that folks who have a lot of money think they have the gift. Well, you can sort that out pretty quick by just, you know, having some discussions and offering them some opportunities, and you find out where their heart's really at. One friend of mine, he's kind of funny, he's a fairly successful businessman, and his wife has the gift, but he doesn't. He told me he came home, and he makes quite a bit of money, he came home one day, said, honey, guess what? I got a big raise. And he said, really? When did it start? Oh, it started 3 weeks ago. I just found out about it. Well, can we retroactively tithe on it? And he felt bad because she didn't even appreciate the fact that he got a raise. All she wanted to do was give it away. And he said, you know, just like tell me that's a great thing, dear. You know, I appreciate you working hard and all that. But that's the difference between the two of them. See, her first thought is, how can we give more of it away? And so folks who have lots of resources may or may not have the gift. But feel free to ask them. Channel them through a network program and find out what their gifts are. If they have the gift, help them develop it. If they have another gift, help them develop that. You know, one of the things that I get questioned about a lot of times, especially by folks who are younger in their faith or who are just kind of confused about how to approach resources, they'll say to me, well, how much should I give? Billions of money come out and I don't know what to give. How much do you need? Well, you need $2 million. But that's how much you should give. You should give what's sacrificial to you. You see, I can't tell someone how much to give, because when I do that, then I'm playing Holy Spirit. You see, then I'm stepping in the role that God should play in their life. And ultimately, they'll have more fulfillment, more satisfaction, and more joy if they make the decision under God's guidance than if I lead them by the hand through the process. Now, I can talk with them and talk about what sacrificial means and talk about what it means to give above and beyond what they feel comfortable giving with, and all those types of things. When it comes to dollar amounts, it's their decision, and it ought to be. Let them make the decision, because long term, they'll feel better about it, God will be honored in the process, and the church will be blessed as a result. You know, one of the things that I feel real strong about is that folks who give need to give strategically. And I'll relate a story to you what I mean by that. I had lunch with a guy about a year ago. Wonderful guy, great heart. He's on a graduated giving program. He gives more and more of his income away every year. Really faithful, grew up in the church, and not in this church, another church. And so I sat down with him and I said, well, tell me, John, how do you use your resources? Well, I do all these things. I give to this mission thing and that food pantry and this church, and I support this place over here. That's great. Boy, how do you keep up with all those places? He said, well, I really don't. Well, I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I'm not really in contact with them. I said, why? Now, how do you know they're doing what they're supposed to be doing? How are they being effective? How are they making a difference? I mean, I'll tell you, there are a lot of ministries out there today, in my opinion, that should be closed down. Not because their vision's wrong, because they're not doing it effectively. So we talk about resources being funneled to the kingdom of God. You need to take those resources and use them the best way you can. Well, there's some ministries out there today, friends, that just aren't doing that. And I'm not criticizing anyone and saying they're bad people, they're immoral, they're unethical. It's just they're not designed to run that ministry that way. It can be done more effectively. So I encouraged him. I said, John, you're a part of all these places. Some places you give because you have passion for them. Other places you give to because you've given there for years. The bottom line is, if you don't know someone in that organization, if you don't meet with them regularly and know if they're accomplishing the objectives, you need to question whether or not you should keep doing that. How do you know they're being fruitful? One missionary organization that I heard of, I think a year or so ago, their goal was, they were an overseas mission group, their goal was to raise up 60 converts internationally. great, except, and look what it cost, it was like $50,000 a piece. Now, I'm not saying those 60 folks don't matter, but $50,000 a convert, I think there's a better way you could do it. You know, I'm not saying those folks don't matter, and their passion and vision isn't right, but there's something wrong. I mean, you need to be able to approach it in different ways than that. And he was investing in this organization, didn't really know what they were doing, you know, and I just kind of think, oh, goodness. I don't think God's honored in that process. I think folks that give need to know whether or not the resources are being used the right way. One thing that I think is really important to understand is that donor development within the church, the type of thing we're talking about tonight, is fairly new to the church, but it's very, very different from the parachurch ministry. It's very different from Focus on the Family and Campus Crusade and International Teams and all these folks. Just some basics. Folks give to the church give more out of a biblical directive, you know, versus parachurch ministries, usually above and beyond type of giving. Folks that are in a church are connected to the organization. They see it week in and week out, maybe one or two times. They know folks there. They're connected to it. There's different motivations for giving there. Folks in parachurch ministries don't have ongoing contact, so you have to increase those through meetings and that type of thing. Parachurch ministries use lots of mailings and all those things to keep their folks informed. I'm not sure that's as appropriate in the church. There's just a lot of differences. You need to understand there's a difference, because if you meet someone from a parachurch who tells you, well, you should be doing it this way, you need to say, well, that works for you, but does that fit with what we're trying to do in the local church? I had one guy tell me, a year and a half ago, he said, tell me about your church. He's a fundraiser. Great guy. Tell me about your church. He said, well, you know, it's this many people and the budget's $9 million or something. Oh, really? $9 million? Yeah, that's great. He said, well, now, like, tell me, you have an annual building fund drive, right? I said, yeah. Great this year. So what'd you raise? It's $2.3 million in cash. It all came in, no pledges, it's all here, we got it all in 2 months. He thought for a second, did some scribbling on the paper, and he said, you know, he said, really, a place your size with that many people should be able to raise $5 million or $6 million in a year-end building drive. I thought about that for a second. I thought, you know, he's right. We could, one time, raise $5 or $6 million, but we would put so much pressure on people, and they'd feel so guilted and beaten up and tired that we'd lose people. We could never have another fundraiser again. They do that type of thing through a lot of slick approaches and all these things. I don't think you need those things. I go back to my tenets. If you're doing what you should be doing as a church, if you're fulfilling God's call and meeting people's needs, people will give. You don't need to have all these other things going on, all these high-pressure deals where you have, you know, folks come in with all kinds of printed materials and big presentations four times in the fall and make these, you know, long-term faith partner pledges and all this stuff, and that's great. But I think you end up wasting a lot of resources to do that. You've got to hire these guys. You got to do it for free. You know, they want a piece of the action, right? Well, I'm not sure that in the end you really get what you paid for, because your folks may not feel great about the process. You spend a lot of money to use in a better way. Okay. Let me talk for a minute about the year-end fund drive, as long as we're on that topic. There are many, many ways to approach capital projects. Capital project is a building or an equipment purchase or something that's pretty substantial in the church. I don't know what the right way is. I'll tell you that right up front. Lots of folks do it lots of ways. Lots of folks do it lots of ways. Some folks think that what you should have is a three-year program where folks make a pledge in the beginning to give so much a month or so much a year over 3 years for the project, and you kind of follow up with them and keep them challenged and that type of thing. Other folks think that you couldn't do it at all. Some folks think they'll do it at the end of the year, in the middle of the year, all kinds of timing issues. Let me tell you how we do it and why we do it the way we do, and you can decide for yourself what the best way is. What we do is, because we're trying to make the primary focus of all of our service times and our ministry the sharing of the gospel, we don't focus tons and tons of time on capital projects. Now, we're starting this fall our final building fund for that building over there. And in fact, next Wednesday and Thursday in the community, I'll present that. Now, what we're going to do is say to folks, here's the program we've been on for the last 5 years. dream began with some thoughts and insights about a need for a new facility, an opportunity for us to more effectively care for our kids and to build into the church body and provide a family room for the church where folks can congregate with relationships, that type of thing. We've raised this much money so far. This is the last building fund that goes $2 million. What we're asking you to do between now and the end of the year, over the next 2 months, is pray through with your family what you think God would need you to do to participate in our building fund. Some folks, a sacrificial gift may be $100. Others may be $10. Others may be $100,000. I don't know what's sacrificial to you. You have to work that out between you and God. What we're asking you to do is, if you're a part of this church, your family's being cared for here, you need to own part of it. The church doesn't belong to the staff or the board of the elders. It's all of ours. And so between now and the end of the year, you think about what participation you'd like to have, and then you can go ahead and make your contribution. By the end of the year, we'll close the building fund down and be done. Now, some folks say, well, gee whiz, you know, you do it at the end of the year, kind of a tough time because you have Christmas and all this stuff. Well, that's true. Other folks say, gee, it's a great time to do it. Tax planning, all that stuff, it's tremendous. Other folks say, well, you know, it's a good idea, but couldn't you spread it out over 7 months? We could do that. I mean, all those are viable options. We've chosen to do it this way with the philosophy that we want to open it up and close it down in a very short window of time so that we don't focus tons of time, energy, and resources on trying to raise money. So we want to continue with the ministry year. Now, you know, we have encouraged one thing more than any other thing in the building fund over the past 5 years, that's participation. I would rather have 5,000 people give $10 apiece than 500 people give $1,000 apiece. Because if only 500 people are giving, something's wrong in the church. I mean, we're not doing something, or folks aren't getting on board, or whatever. But you don't want to be highly dependent on a few folks. You know, I think last year there were 5,000 families participating in the building fund. Now, I don't know if that means a lot to you. To me, it means an awful lot. Because prior to that, we had like, you know, 2,500, 3,000, and that was great, but I really wanted folks to own it. In the church, we wanted everyone to feel a part of the thing. You know, my daughter is going to grow up in that building over there. She's 11 months old, 12 months old next week, and we made the biggest investment we ever made last year in that building, knowing that that was an investment in her future. And I hope other folks feel the same way. The kids are going to grow up through Promised Land and Sunlight and Impact and Prime Time and all those things. Small group experiences and network and evangelism and weekend services and new community worship times, all those things are opportunities for them to grow. But the facilities that we have, we built so they can grow. And they need to help us as a team, as a family, to get those things on the way. We do a balance between the weekend and the community in terms of building funds. We'll probably have more emphasis on the community than on the weekend. We will mention it to the weekend, let them know that this is happening. But again, our goal is not to extract resources from folks who are investigating Christ. Our goal is to share the vision of what the West Expansion is all about. Now, one of the things that's very, very important when you talk about fundraising or development or whatever is that if you go to someone and you say, we just built this West Expansion, it cost us $20 million. It's got 204,000 square feet, 27 classrooms, a food service, all this stuff. Folks aren't going to be so impassioned about that. Because who wants to invest in bricks and mortar? Does that excite you, building buildings? That'd be much for me. But you tell them, we're building this building, and it's going to be a place with child-centered classrooms to allow our kids to grow up and learn about Christ. There'll be a gymnasium, an activity center, where kids, our high school and junior high kids, can go and work out all that extra energy they have at that stage of life, work it out such that they can work that off and sit down and quietly listen to the gospel being presented. We built a family room for the church in the atrium, a place where folks can go and build relationships, where they can spend time before and after services with super friends that are brought in with family, enjoying time together, talking about the message of the service. They can meet folks here during the week for small group Bible studies or for relational development, whatever. There's an education center on the third floor, a place where folks can grow and learn about Christ, where the facility is designed for folks to comfortably sit for longer periods of time to hear about network and evangelism and all those types of things. See, that's vision. That tells people what you're trying to accomplish. We're not trying to build a building. We're trying to do ministry. The building is only a tool that helps us do that. They need to know, why are you building this thing? What's the point? Well, we're crowded. We need more square footage. Well, that doesn't excite anybody. And that isn't why you're building it anyway. I mean, I'm certain you think that's why, but really, go to the root issue. What's the church all about? We're trying to do all these things in the lives of people. The goal is to change people's lives. So when you talk about vision, when you talk about helping folks understand what it is you're all about, you need to help them understand the core vision, the core philosophy. We want to help unchurched people become fully devoted followers of Christ, irreligious people. That's the goal. And then we're going to play it out through these uniquely designed facilities. But yes, they cost a lot of money, but there's a lot of folks here. You know, if you look at a weekend service, you have 22 or 23 or 2,500 kids in Promised Land. If you look at dinner time before New Community or after, you have 600 or 700 people sitting in there. The place is packed. You need a facility that big. And so we're just trying to say to people, we built this for you. We're encouraging you to participate in it, not only in using the facility, but in, you know, paying for it as well. It's all our responsibility. Okay. The final formal point I want to talk about is a very brief point, one that was covered more in a seminar last night by Warren Beach. It's our Good Sense Ministry. Good Sense is a ministry that was founded about 6 years ago, maybe seven, and it's designed to teach people about stewardship. Its original focus was on folks who were in financial difficulty. Folks would come to us with all kinds of financial troubles. They'd be 2 months behind in their mortgage payment. They'd be 3 months behind in their car payment. They'd have credit card debt, all these things. What do I do? Can you guys give me some money? So the answer isn't always to give them money. That may be part of the solution. But we need to re-educate them. We need to train them, give them guidance, hold them accountable, help them build a budget, understand what it means to be a good steward. And so Good Sense started out doing that. Well, over time, we've broadened the philosophy a little bit, and it's still under some new directional change even as we speak. But there are probably three arms to Good Sense Ministry. One is this kind of code red area that I talked about initially. Those are the folks who are really in trouble. Folks who come to us who are about to be evicted, or folks who have no idea how to start to tackle the massive debt they've piled up over the last couple of years. So we sit down with them, with some folks in the church who are lay people, but who we've given some training to help them develop a budget and then develop a plan of attack on how to pay all this stuff off. The goal is, hopefully, to help them understand this process, biblical principles of stewardship, what the Bible says about handling the resources and doing it in such a way that they end up taking care of all their needs, able to give to the church and save for the future and do all these things that are very important. The second group that we have is kind of what we call a code green group. And these are for folks who may not have ever had any insight or education or training about financial planning or stewardship or personal finance. We'll take them through a basic course of saying, here's what you should know about insurance. Here's what you should know about buying a car. Here's what you should know about life insurance, about savings for retirement, about college, about whatever, a whole host of issues over a four-week period, we tell them all these things. And it gives them an opportunity with a biblical slant to understand the basics of what good stewardship is. We do a budget seminar every January for the whole church, about 1,000 people come every year. We sit down and give them an opportunity to learn about stewardship, how to prepare a budget, what's involved in keeping yourself accountable over time, comparing this year to last year, and all those things. And then finally, a good thing to have kind of a teaching arm that we're starting to develop as well. We can bring in outside speakers or bring in folks who have some expertise, talk about specific topics. There's really nowhere folks can go today, at least anywhere they can go that's objective, to get information about financial planning or about just being a good steward. And they can go to their stockbroker or whatever. You've got an interest in telling them what to do. Financial planners, oh, we'll develop a plan for you. Sure, $700 plus 6 months a year and a commission on all your investments. And, well, that's great. But you can't really trust they're being objective. There's something in it for them. In the church, you put a program together where folks can be certain that there's nothing in it for us. We're not doing this to, like, get a commission out of them or to get a sale. All the folks that are in Good Sense are kind of in agreement. They won't do business with anyone they deal with in a ministry relationship through Good Sense. They kind of say, well, that's not our deal. You know, we're just here to serve, and if they need a referral, I'll try and find someone and send them to, but it can't be me. We're trying to teach folks, bottom line, an overall biblical approach to resources. We want them to honor God with all they have. And whether that's through donor relations, whether that's through Good Sense, whether it's through building fund presentations or teaching about giving, all of our goal is to teach them the full counsel of God. Ultimately, what they do with it is their decision. We can challenge them and encourage them and lay out the principles, but it's in their hands, in their heart, to figure out what they should do. Now, with all that said, I'm going to kind of stop my little presentation, 45 minutes or so, and we'll just take some time for question and answers. I'll answer or try and answer anything that you want to ask about, and feel free to ask anything. There's no question it's a dumb question, only one that wasn't asked. There may be things in your ministry specifically that you need guidance on. My guess is if you need guidance, someone else probably here needs guidance as well on the same topic. The question is, will I speak to missions giving? What specifically would you like to know?
Well, I'm just wondering. I haven't heard in academia a lot of emphasis on the outreach, say, foreign missions, for example, or nationalism. I'm just wondering to what extent that's part of the vision and what
the kind of. We do have a foreign missions program. We call it International Ministry. I'll just give you a brief thumbnail sketch of what we're doing. We've partnered with an orphanage in Haiti, or in Mexico, excuse me, a hospital in Haiti, a boys' orphanage in Jamaica, some churches in Europe. We've done some international conferences as well, in addition to some partnerships we've had with some international ministries worldwide in India and other countries, where we have gone in and supported them with resources, staff, and equipment to help them be effective in their culture. Our belief is that really someone who's already established in the third world or a different culture will be much more effective than anyone we send over there. So that person has to learn the culture and all these things, and even once they learn it, they're not really accepted. That's our philosophy. It's not the right way, not the best way. That's what we feel God's laid on our heart. That gives you kind of a picture. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
At what point did you feel it was worthwhile for you to invest in foreign missions instead of just investing in inward gain?
The question is, at what point did we feel it was appropriate to invest in foreign missions? You know, it's interesting. Our international ministries program is probably only 6 years old, maybe five. We have not had up to that point either the resources nor the point person to really lead us in a vision for IM. Now, we kind of came to the point where we felt like God was leading us to do that. Some folks in the body were raised up that we felt could confidently and carefully lead us down that road. And so when we started the program, we met for a whole year, just sitting down looking at what the philosophy is, trying to work through, well, this is the right way, this is the wrong way that we feel we should approach it. So in our case, it was, you know, two-thirds of the way through our history, but we really poured lots of resources into foreign missionaries. Yes?
What about
his question is, how do you do development in the new church? There's only one thing that you can do, the most important thing of all, is to cast a vision for your ministry. Now, there's lots of ways you can approach that. Let me tell you how I think you should do it and how you shouldn't do it. I don't think the way to do it is sit down with a guy at lunch with a little flip chart and flip through page after page. When you get done, say, how much can I count on you for? Now, some folks believe that's the right way to do it, and it may be effective. I just don't think that's the right way. I think a better way is to say, Bob, listen, here's what Willow Creek's doing. Here's what we're all about. Here's where we're headed. Here's the vision God's laid in our hearts. Here are key people. If you'd like to participate in this, I'd encourage you to pray about it and think about it. Let us know what you want to do. I mean, that way, it's his decision. There's no pressure. He understands what we're all about. I haven't walked him through some slick deal trying to bring him to a close and sale. So I think the most important thing you can do in an early startup church is to say, here's our vision. Do you want to join us? If you're God leading you, if he does, that's great. If not, that's fine too. Yes?
Does the church carry a certain amount of debt before they move on to the next phase, or do they remove that and then go into
the next phase? Do we have debt? Is your question? We only have debt really on our initial building. That auditorium right there has about $1.3 million outstanding on it. The entire West expansion was built with cash, except for a short window of time from February of 92 to December of 92, just 10 months. We had a short-term construction loan that will pay off. We've already started to pay it off. Now it'll be paid off in 2 months. We really try and do everything we do with cash.
And it's all up front before you start?
No. What we've done over the years in the course of these projects is we have taken time to lay out a plan, a financial plan. Now, when we started the West expansion, I laid out a 5-year cash flow plan. And what I built into that was some commitments from our operating budget, some commitments from our building fund, some commitments from interest income, worked all that together and said, we can do this. under these parameters. It's very important to understand the difference between faith and foolishness when it comes to trusting God. He gave you a brain, you need to use it. You know, I get nervous when folks say, we're just going to trust God for it. Well, what does that mean? I mean, is there anything out there to really substantiate that belief? I mean, this guy's going to drop $20 million on you? Or do you have a plan how to get there? Well, if you take some time to think about the plan, I think that's probably prudent. Remember, you know, you have a lot of things at risk when you start to build a building like that you can't pay for. Your relationship with the community and the contractor and the folks in your church and all those things, a lot at risk. So it's prudent, I think, to be careful in planning it out, to have some understanding of what is reasonable. I mean, if $20 million isn't reasonable, you should know that going into it. Maybe you can get $10 million, no problem. That's great. But if you can't get the extra $10 million, what do you do? One of the problems with debt is that it limits future flexibility in the church. What happens is, let's take the way you feel like you should build this big, huge building. So you build it, and in 2 years from now, the Holy Spirit is leading you to do something else, something different. You can't respond, because you're so tied up and paying for what you already built that you can't move ahead. I'm not saying debt's wrong. What I am saying is use it responsibly. Make sure you understand the impact it has in the organization. Yep.
So before you ever had a building on this property and you were in another facility, you were generating
absolutely
capital to build whatever you started with it.
In every project that we've had, we have raised money in advance for the project, and through the course of the project continued to do so. When we started construction in the West Expansion, we had already set aside $10 million in the bank. And then we had a plan over the next 3 years to raise the balance. Before construction began, we had almost half of the cost set aside with a very clear plan how the rest would be appropriated.
Is that done on a percentage basis or capabilities?
We just kind of do it on common sense. We understand the nature of the church, and we know our organization and our people here, and we ask God for guidance and kind of put all that together and come up with a solution.
So then, let's go back. Most of it, I assume, maybe I'm something wrong, but I am at least from a very small church. That is not, we don't have a plan here that's half this big. So we're in a high school auditorium renting it most of the month,
mm-hmm.
and we're generating or trying to raise funds on an ongoing basis. Do we raise funds until we have enough to initially build whatever kind of first structure we want? Or do you do it piecemeal or halfway or a percentage?
Or do
we cut off and start building, I guess?
There's a lot of things that play into that. One is, how much will a bank lend you? My experience is that early on in churches, they generally want you to raise half the resources for the building and they'll finance the other half. So that kind of sets some parameters right there. You need to talk to a lender and figure out what they're willing to do as far as participating with you. But I encourage you, I mean, it's a Holy Spirit-directed decision. I can't tell you when you should or shouldn't build. It may be that you should have all kinds of debt. Maybe in your situation, God's saying, don't take on any debt. Raise every dime before you build. There isn't any hard and fast rule. See, in business, you can scientifically approach problems and make decisions, but in ministry, there's the Holy Spirit factor that kind of makes it a little more difficult to always predict exactly what you should do. So in your case, what you need to do is get your leadership team together and pray about it, toss in some common sense, maybe get some information from some banks and make a decision. Yes, ma'am. There was no, for the building fund, there was no long-term pledge. In fact, this year, in the fall of 92, we'll have a building fund where we'll just talk to the folks and say, here's where we're at this year. This is the commitment we've been talking about for years, the $2 million commitment this year that we're trying to meet. Hope you'll join us in participating.
What's
the cost of the facility? On the books, it's listed at about $40 million. Now, could you sell it for $40 million? Probably not. Could you rebuild it for $40 million? Probably not. I mean, I don't know. You know, you probably sell it for less than $40 and rebuild it for more.
So I think
you'll
fight the cost. Is that just
the
buildings or is that
$40 million would be all the facilities other than the property.
The property
is what? Oh, it's probably worth $3 million, something like that. Yeah. Oh, okay. Go ahead, I'll give you a second. Go ahead. Our seekers can give in the weekend service. That statement that I made at the beginning, this service is designed for you as a gift. It's not designed to extract resources from you, that type of thing. They can give during the offering time if they want to. Oh, yeah. Sure.
What is your operating budget for this service?
Operating budget is about $11 million, $212,000 a week. And about 60% goes towards salaries. The balance goes toward whatever else.
You have designated giving. I'm trying to understand that you give all the money to the leaders, basically, and they're determining so much those buildings, so much those to other areas. You allow the people to say, I want this much of those buildings, and I want this much of those general.
There are about 9 places in the church folks can give to. We encourage their primary offerings and tithes to go to the general operating fund to pay for lights and salaries and programs and all those things. The balance of giving that folks give can be directed to places like the building fund, Camp Paradise, the food pantry, the youth ministries, the benevolence fund, international ministries. There's places folks can give. The problem you have to be careful with is that in some ministries, they allow folks to designate so much, they have a big pile of cash they can't spend. So you can designate for this and that and Harry Jones Memorial and all this, and that's great. But at some point, you got to say, whoa, time out. God's leading us to leave this place. We need to have discretion about how those resources are used. We have interest income that comes from 2 primary places. One is through an investment program we have with our bank. It's called a sweep account. What they do is we have certain balances that are minimums that we want to maintain. If there are additional resources above that, they'll invest it overnight for us in some money market type funds that are very risk-free and stable. The money comes back to us the next morning, but they're in interest that way. Second, we've invested in government-insured investments, whether it's CDs under $100,000 at banks or through treasuries, you know, all kinds of large block government securities, government agency securities. We have some folks in the church who work with those types of things. Pretty much. Our philosophy on investment is that if you plan to invest anything with a long-term window to it, you better plan to hold it till the end of the term. See, what happens if you're thinking about investments is, let's say you buy something that's got a 30-year term on it. You buy it for $100 today. Well, let's say that all of a sudden the interest rates skyrocket to 25%. The value of your investment just declined to about $75. And that's the inverse relationship between interest rates and principal. And so you have to be careful when you invest in things that they're not market sensitive. If they are market sensitive, be willing to hold it until they mature because you have a lot of money at risk. Yes?
Yeah, what's your background and how did you get involved in this?
Let's see. Well, I graduated from college, and I spent 2 years in the business community. I worked for a property and casualty insurance brokerage company, and we did big insurance programs, like for the church and other places like that. When I was 23, I left there and came here. And the church was a lot smaller then. It was just me. I wasn't qualified to do the job, to be honest with you. I had no accounting background. I had a finance degree. But they knew me, and there were some folks on the board who worked with me, and so I was able to grow with the organization, and it's been a great experience and a lot of fun.
What kind of help did you get out of your board?
A lot. We have a very involved board. A comment about the board of directors is kind of off the track, but I'll make it anyway. The question we were asking today about board members is, what is it they're going to contribute to the organization? Not financially, but giftedness, time, energy. How are they going to make a difference? If they can't make a difference, they shouldn't be on your board. It used to be the board position you assigned to folks as kind of an honor or as a result of lots of giving and all that type of thing. Well, that's great. But ultimately, folks ought to be there because they can make a difference, because God gifted them to serve in that leadership role. If they can't do that, that's great. Just put them in a place where they can serve effectively. Your board, you know, our board here is very involved. I talk with a few of our board members every week on a regular basis, have relationships with them. We're very open in communication. It's very important, I think, to keep it that way. Yes?
Probably a lot of people that are in this workshop right now are connected with the denominational church, and that brings with it financial obligation. And just wondering, being part of a denominational church, does that limit a local church the sense that they may not be able to do what Little Creek has done?
I don't know the answer to that question. The question was, what happens if you're part of a denomination? Do folks have the same opportunities Willow Creek does? It depends on the denomination. It depends on what their financial requirements are for you to be a part of that. I think that if you're doing what God's calling you to do, you can do anything you want. But you need to be sensitive to the Holy Spirit and trust Him for direction.
Does Willow Creek have a foundation, and do you, the church, encourage bequests?
We have an endowment program. An endowment program is designed specifically to benefit a benevolence fund. So folks in the community who are in need can come to us, and through several services we offer, we'll try and help them get back on track. One of the ways we do that sometimes is through contributing resources to them. Yes?
I want to affirm your emphasis on the caring ministry of the church, the vision of the church, and that's foundational to the giving that occurs. This week are negotiating. We're a brand new church, and we're just negotiating for the purchase of a large building that seems to be way beyond our reach. We just filled up a small group. And inside the first 2 days, over half of what would be the mortgage payment people volunteered to us would have to do this. Which we gave over and above their faithful time. You know, that's just a wonderful thing. We have to be unified and agree that this is the direction we're going. And if we're in a traditional church where there's opposition to the direction we're going, the first thing that I think is effective is to get them with us.
We have had some support from outside sources. In fact, we had substantial support from some families outside the church to assist us in building the West expansion. You know, there are resources out there available, whether it's through grants from foundations, that type of thing, which we haven't pursued at this point, or through folks who just believe in your ministry and want to partner with you to kind of make an investment. So some folks have done that.
Have you been able to see any matching gift fund opportunities?
No, we haven't done any matching gift type of things. We're not opposed to doing that. We're kind of in the earliest stages of development. We really just started doing this about a year and a half ago. And so we haven't done anything complicated or time-intensive. It's pretty much been kind of a sideline for me, in addition to some other things to do over the last year and a half. So we're trying to get more proactive about finding new and creative ways to produce revenue for the church, whether it's through grants and foundations and matching funds and all those type of things.
Do you have a donor list divided up amongst the categories, categorized with your team of how to respond, how to interact with those people?
I pretty much do most of the donor interaction type things. Bill does some. A lot of them are just folks who call me. So I want to talk to you about this or that, or some relationships I've initiated, but more often than not, they've initiated with me. Just kind of talk and just say, I want to talk to you about this or that. Usually what we'll do is we'll recognize a larger gift. You know, if someone gives a $5,000 gift, we'd recognize that. It's a lot of money. Yeah, I never even know them. I mean, never have met them. You know, many times it's surprising. A check will show up for a whole bunch of money. I've never heard of this person before. I think, my goodness, where did they come from? And why are they making this huge commitment to this place? Are they serving anywhere? Are they involved? Do they know anything about what we're about? Why we're here, what we're trying to accomplish? So we try and get in touch with them and at least appreciate what they're doing.
Do you have any kind of an idea as far as what percentage of the people that are coming here are seekers versus actually saved people? And if you do, are you finding that your members are giving 90% of your funds and the seekers are 10%? Or?
How many folks are seekers in the church? Well, let me just say this. You know, 5,000 to 6,000 people come to New Community. My guess is all those folks are believers. In addition, my guess is there are a number of believers who come on the weekend who don't come midweek. That's about the best answer I can give you as to how many folks are seekers in the church. Your second question was?
Well, say then maybe half your people are believers. Mm-hmm. Is that 50% giving 90% of your funds?
A small percentage gives a large percentage of our resources, like any other church. If you just do some basic analysis, you say, let's say, for example, the basic average income around here is $25,000. Which is, that's what it is. If you look at the number of people who give $2,500 or more in a given year, it's very small, 2,200 people maybe, given a donor base of 12,000. So we're not that different from the average church. There's a smaller percentage of folks do a lot of the serving and giving, and a lot of other folks ride the coattails. We're trying to change that, by the way.
$25,000 per person, per
capita? My point there was that the average income in this area was $25,000
per person.
Right, yeah.
Do you have an active program of teaching the children, Promised Land kids or high school kids
Now, the kids do give in Promised Land and in Impact. I have a vision for a program that I hope we're going to do next year called Kids and Finances. Maybe the first one we designed for parents to help them learn how to educate their kids about stewardship. But a few years back, I did do a program for the high school kids where I basically just sat down for an hour and a half, and talked to them about finances in their terms. I talked about examples they could relate to. I talked in language they could understand. I didn't know what I was talking about, but they understood it, and that was great. So I think that's important. It's important to go both to the parents and the kids. Yes, sir.
Do you encourage giving from the pulpit?
Yes. We do. And now, again, I go back to my statement there. It's a teaching thing. We encourage giving. We don't so much ask for money. It's a philosophical difference that seems small, but the difference between the two is enormous. Jim Bethner is probably the best, or one of the best, teachers I've ever heard teaching on giving. He hates asking for money. He hates it. It just appalls him. He doesn't feel comfortable doing it, all these things, but he's effective at getting folks to give with a biblical base to it. He doesn't talk about amounts and pressure and all these things. There's a big difference. Yes?
If the average time is 5 years for the seeker to start giving, what happens from 0 to 5 years that they all of a sudden start giving?
I don't know that it's 5 years. Maybe someone said that earlier this week. My guess is probably less than that, any closer to two. If a seeker stays around 2 years, my guess is he's given by that point. But we try to get them connected relationally, get them serving, get them involved in the church. We try to have contact through what we're calling our small groups ministry, where folks get assimilated into the church. We try to do things to make it easy for them to approach us and get involved. We don't try and draw them in terms of, oh, you're new here. Oh, come on, I'll take you over to this thing. Well, we just try and give them the opportunity to approach us and say, I'd like to get involved somewhere.
Nowhere along the line is our counseling or our finances brought up. It's more of being connected and feeling involved.
We don't sit down and say, if you're really a Christian, then the first thing you better do is give. We don't get into that.